This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In a report released Thursday, Amnesty says that at least 150 pro-Biafra activists have been killed by security forces in southeastern Nigeria since August 2015.
That's Chika Odua with details of a new report from Amnesty International. Details next.
Also at the African Arab Summit in Equatorial Guinea, Egyptian President El-Sisi says countries should cooperate and share experiences to solve their problems. And one of four armed groups in Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, has agreed to end the recruitment of child soldiers.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
A new report says at least 150 supporters of the Biafra separatist movement in Nigeria have been killed by Nigerian security forces. Amnesty International says the killings took place over the course of a year as security forces led by the military launched a crackdown on the separatists. Chika Adua reports from Abuja.
Agatha Ikefuna is a nurse who lives in Onitsha. It is a city in southeastern Nigeria where pro-Biafran events have taken place. She says that roads were blocked and chaos erupted during a May 30th rally to mark the Nigerian Civil War, also known as the Biafra War.
I was afraid to drop my child in school. There was no movement. People were being killed.
Shots were fired at the rally. Some witnesses said it was the police. Others say it was the pro-Biafrans. Ikefuna says it was thieves who infiltrated the protest. Whoever did the shooting, by the end of the rally, dozens of civilians and at least two policemen lay dead. Amnesty International says at least 60 people were killed at several Biafra remembrance events that had taken place in the region that day.
I remember interviewing one protester who was shot on his leg, and he went while he was running away. He fell into the gutter and tried to hit himself. And then a particular soldier came to him, dragged him out of the gutter, and poured acid on him. And that man is still recovering from those injuries.
That's Mahmoud Kamara, the interim director of Amnesty International Nigeria. He tells VOA that witnesses reported seeing Nigerian soldiers taking dead bodies to the local army barracks. But May 30th was not the only day pro-Biafra activists died at the hands of Nigerian security forces. In a report released Thursday, Amnesty says that at least 150 pro-Biafra activists have been killed by security forces in southeastern Nigeria since August 2015. The human rights organization says the military has led the campaign against the Biafra movement. It says an analysis of video and witness accounts shows that soldiers often fire live ammunition with little or no warning to disperse crowds. Amnesty says it also found evidence of extrajudicial executions. The Nigerian army has denied the charges. A director in the Nigerian military, not officially authorized to speak to VOA, said that Amnesty International's report is not accurate and is a gross exaggeration and misrepresentation of what is happening. She said the Nigerian army investigated the May 30th events and concluded that the Biafra activists were at fault. She said the army plans to hold a hearing to present its findings. Kamara says the army's response to the report is not new.
This is a copy and paste response to our allegations. It's the same thing that they've been saying for years, because we have been calling on them repeatedly to conduct independent, impartial, and thorough investigations into allegations of serious human rights abuses.
Biafra declared independence in 1967, but was absorbed back into Nigeria after a three-year war. The leader of the current pro-Biafran movement, Nnamdi Kanu, was arrested last year on charges of treason. He is still in custody in the Nigerian capital on orders of President Muhammadu Buhari. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
at the African Arab Summit, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi spoke about the importance of sustainable development and improving living conditions for average citizens. The Egyptian leader is among those attending the summit in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. El-Sisi says both Arab and African countries face challenges such as cross-border organized crime, refugees, and illegal migration. He says countries must cooperate and share experiences to solve these problems. He says there's a link between deterioration of international peace and security and the challenges of poverty and slow development. On other issues, El-Sisi is quoted as saying, Egypt supports the national armies in Syria, Libya, and Iraq to deal with extremist elements. The Egyptian president came to power after the military's ouster of President Mohamed Morsi. He has cracked down on Islamists. Egypt also faces frequent attacks by militants in the Sinai.
Do Africans still want democracy? That's the title of a new survey from Afrobarometer, a pan-African nonpartisan research network. It shows that a 10-year upward trend of Africans demanding democracy ended in 2012. There has been a downturn ever since. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Citizens in 36 African countries were questioned about their views on democracy. Professor Robert Mattis is the lead author of the Afrobarometer report.
Since democracy broke out around the world in the 1980s and early 1990s, we're just interested in to what extent ordinary people want to stick with the project, to what extent they're committed to democracy and are ready to reject the siren calls of authoritarian alternatives. We asked a series of questions, whether people always prefer democracy, what they think about other alternatives, such as military rule, one-party rule, or a strongman president who doesn't have to worry about elections and legislature.
The political studies professor is director of the Democracy in Africa Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. He's also a visiting scholar at Princeton University. Mattis highlights the overall survey findings.
68% say that democracy is always preferable, and anywhere between 70 and 80% would reject military rule and one-party rule, etc. But when you put all that together and say how many people say yes to all those questions, give the pro-democratic response to each one, and the current survey, only 46% said yes to all of those things. And that is a significant downturn from our last surveys, which we did in 2013, 2014, in which support for democracy in Africa or demand for democracy had reached a high point of 51%.
But why the decline?
What's very clear is demand dropped in each country that had an election that was flawed. African support for democracy has what we would call an intrinsic element, meaning the people who support democracy, that many of them do it because they have a formal education, they use news media at high rates, they engage with the political process, and they often have a more procedural view of democracy. They were learned about in school as elections, about legislatures, about representation, about rights and liberties.
Mattis also says people support democracy if it delivers the goods.
For some people, it's the economic goods, growth and reducing inequality. And other people support it because they think it delivers political goods like stability and peace and freedom. And amongst the political elements, we find that elections are some of the most important determinants of whether people think they're actually living in a democracy and thus whether they want a democracy. And where elections are seen by people as completely above board and with a high level of public integrity, demand has maintained or even increased. But where large percentages of the people have doubts about the integrity of the election, demand for democracy has dropped precipitously.
The demand for democracy is greater in some African countries than others.
You go to some of Africa's oldest democracies, Mauritius, for example, 74%. Senegal, 2/3. Botswana, 2/3. Zambia, 60%. And even in some new multi-party systems that are just struggling to re-implant democracy or sustain it for the very first time, like Ivory Coast or Burundi, you have high levels of support.
But Burundi has seen about a year and a half of political violence. It began in April of 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. He won re-election, despite critics calling it unconstitutional. In Mozambique, The Afrobarometer survey shows only 9% of citizens support democracy. One political party has dominated there since the end of the Civil War in 1992 and the first multi-party elections in 1994. Rebel attacks resumed in 2013. North African countries have some very low levels of support for democracy as well. For example, in Algeria, it's just 21%, Sudan 17%, and Egypt only 13%. Researchers were not able to poll residents in the world's newest country, South Sudan. It's suffering from years of conflict, violence, and political unrest. Demand for democracy is higher in urban areas in Africa and among those with a high school or university education. The same holds true for middle-class business people and professionals and those who hold clerical jobs.
That is the group we think have been rising in Africa over the last 5 to 10 years with the sustained growth that many countries had. People with a job are much more likely to support democracy than people who are partially employed or unemployed.
Professor Mattis stresses that support for democracy hinges on elections and whether citizens see them as free and fair. A party refusing to accept the results of an election can have a damaging effect. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
One of four armed groups in Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, SPLMN, has agreed to end and prevent the recruitment and use of children in conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the group signed an action plan for carrying out the agreement.
To date, 59 armed groups and government forces are listed in the UN Secretary General's report on children and armed conflict as having committed grave violations against children. The violations include killing and maiming, attacks on schools and hospitals, sexual violence, recruitment and abduction of children. By signing the action plan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North hopes to get itself off the list. The UN Special Representative for the Secretary General on Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi, says the list is a kind of prod to armed groups.
One party to conflict is ready to cooperate, is ready to stop the violation. I would like to encourage them to stop the violation, move forward, rather than blaming them. If people don't act, then we name and shame.
Implementation of the action plan will begin as soon as the UN Children's Fund, which is the lead agency in this process, and its partners gain access to the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile State, where the SPLMN is located. UN aid agencies have not had access to those areas for about 5 years, a situation the SPLMN blames on the Sudanese government. Once the UN is able to reach the areas, Zarugi says aid workers will screen the troops to see how many children are in the ranks of the armed group. SPLMN Chairman Malik Aga tells VOA that a United Nations report in 2012 had listed 11 children as having been recruited, but a more recent report, he says, puts that number at 4.
The problem is not the number, whether it's 1 or 10, that's not the problem. The problem is the principle. Does the child, whether they are 2 or 3, whatever number, that deserve not to be subjected to others and his life subjected to difficulties and combat areas. And I think that is a matter of principle, not a matter of number.
UNICEF will oversee the demobilization and reintegration of the child soldiers into their local communities. The agency will trace the children's families and provide them with education and psychological care to help them cope with their trauma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, today is Thanksgiving Day in the U.S. It's a national holiday when Americans get together, often with extended family and friends, to enjoy a festive meal and offer gratitude. This year, Thanksgiving follows a bitterly contentious presidential election season that often strained relations between family members who backed different candidates. VOA's Adam Phillips asked some fellow Americans explains how Donald Trump's victory will affect their Thanksgiving.
It's Tuesday, 2 days before Thanksgiving in Manhattan's Times Square. Like many tourists here, Mary Stokowski of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and her sister Peggy Brown of Tustin, California, are reflecting on the recent presidential election. Mary speaks first.
I like Mr. Trump. I think that he's going to do a good job. If we let him do some things that he would like to do, maybe not make some quick judgments, I think he might do a good job for everybody.
Are there people within your family who are more for the Clinton folks? And I'm wondering, you know, if there's going to be a conversation. Are people going to be avoiding the subject?
No, I think that there will be some listening going on, but there will be some strong opinions that will be said. One of our nieces is a very staunch Mrs. Clinton fan, so she was crying, she was ranting and raving on Facebook, and so we might not want to get into it with her because she might run out the door. I don't know.
What do you say?
In my family in California, we just stay away from the subject on Thanksgiving. We want to have a really good time, and if you start getting into politics, it alienates people, so we stay away from it.
Silence about the election will also be on the menu for Dina Sayed Ahmed's family, but for different reasons.
My family is Muslim. We're all Arab. My parents are immigrants. My two older sisters are also immigrants. So I think you can kind of get the idea that we're all kind of opposed to Trump, given our background and given the way he's been speaking about people who come from our background.
Is there fear in your family?
Naturally, there would be fear because you can tell that I'm Muslim. You can tell that I'm not white. I mean, I don't know. We haven't really talked about it.
Are you going to talk about it, though?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's been the coping mechanism so far, like just to ignore it until something really bad happens.
Israeli-American Renat Pinchas says the Jewish family that's invited her for turkey and all the trimmings takes an opposite approach. Her hosts were Hillary supporters, but their in-laws backed Trump.
And they have been at odds for months now, and they're all very, very temperamental. So I'm sure it'll be very angst-ridden slash exciting slash hopefully coming together at some point Thanksgiving.
What did your friend yourself say about the upcoming meal?
She was hoping she could kind of bury the hatchet, settle everything, and hopefully have some peace. But I don't think anyone's opinions are going to be changed. I think everyone's just going to be really stubborn and stick to their own guns. So probably things will escalate to a point where it gets tense, and then we'll just bring out the dessert or something.
Levi Drake from Fort Myers, Florida, comes from an interracial family where the votes were divided.
The black side of my family voted Trump, where the white side voted mixed.
You think there's going to be any tension around the dinner table?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's not a chance. They'll share their views, but obviously, you know, regardless if you like it or not, you have to hope the best for our president-elect and hope that he makes the right decisions. Also, it's like no one wants to be in bad spirits.
Cesar Romero is a Mexican-American whose entire family voted for Clinton. For them, Trump's victory will mean somber spirits.
We really weren't expecting a Trump victory. And it's just like a lot of soul-searching now. Like, I'm a U.S. citizen, fortunately, but not everyone is in that same boat, you know? With Thanksgiving, since my family's pretty left-wing, I think we're just going to be thinking of ways of how to help people and, like, figure out, like, why we had this vote.
Politics will be a big part of the conversation for Jeff and his family from Minnesota. They were just as passionate about supporting Trump as the Renaros were about supporting Clinton.
I think we're all very thankful for it. I don't know if it necessarily has anything to do with Thanksgiving, but it's just knowing that things are going to change.
Indeed, most Americans can agree that the transfer of power from President Barack Obama to President-elect Donald Trump will signal some dramatic changes, both in tone and policy. However, the expectation that the transfer will be peaceful, if not always smooth, is one big reason for gratitude for all Americans this Thanksgiving Day, 2016. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Mali has yet to recover from the events of 2012, when unrest triggered by a coup sent hundreds of thousands of Malians fleeing to other countries. A group of refugee musicians is now hoping it can encourage Malians to unite and shun the extremist groups that briefly controlled the country's north. Bram Postumas reports from Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou.
¶¶ This music comes from a tradition that goes back 800 years. It has been kept alive by families, in this case, the Kouyates and Diabates. Griots, they are called. But Malians prefer the term Djali, storytellers, whose work it is to conserve history and make social commentary. Their existence is absolutely central to Malian identity. Malians simply cannot imagine a world without music. It's the fabric of their society. That fabric has been torn in several places since 2012, when Mali experienced a Tuareg rebellion, a coup in Bamako, and then a jihadist takeover of the north. These religious extremists did the unthinkable. They banned music. Malians fled the north and ended up in Burkina Faso, Niger and Mauritania, where they still live. Some are in the remote Mbera camp in eastern Mauritania, an unlikely setting for a concert. Mani Ansar, the director of the celebrated festival in the desert, recounts how he arrived at the camp with a group of artists from all corners of Mali. He did not quite know how the welcome would be.
On a pu arriver au camp des réfugiés.
He says if you're a minister or another politician and you show up at the camp, the refugees will throw stones at you. But in the end, the reception was warm and overwhelming. That's the power of culture, says Ansar. Everybody helped to build a stage using sandbags as support material for 50,000 people living so far from home. This was the first time to reconnect with their country and its music. We just partied for two nights, Ansar told VOA. The concert in Mauritania is part of a long series of concerts on three continents. It's called the Cultural Caravan for Peace, and Mani Ansar has been the driving force behind it. The caravan has two main aims, he explains. One is to contribute to reconciliation in Mali. Nothing can carry this message more effectively than music. Seeing singers and musicians from the north, the center, the south on a stage together sends a powerful message of peace and understanding. And the other purpose of the caravan is to offer a different voice to the seductive sound of jihadist extremism, the ideology that sent so many of Mali's musicians into exile. This call for unity and against extremism is travelling around the world. There are stops in Morocco, where the caravan twins with the Taragalt festival on the edge of the Sahara Desert, Ségou on the Niger River, Burkina Faso. And next year, Malian music will dazzle crowds in Europe and the United States. Beautiful sounds carrying a beautiful message. If you are near the caravan, don't miss it. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.